Some of you might never have done electrophoresis before, but probably most of you have in another course. Regardless of whether you have or haven't, electrophoresis is one of several basic separation techniques used in science, along with what other examples? What are some other separation techniques? Chromatography of all sorts. There's different kinds of chromatography, but those are all separation techniques. What else? How have you separated things in here already? Centrifugation is separation technique. Chromatography was probably the one you did earliest in life, when you put water coloring on a paper towel and then it spreads out into a rainbow. That's chromatography. Distillation is also. But anyway, each of these different separation techniques has a specific basis or set of bases on which the separation takes place. In other words, the particles separate from each other on the basis of something. In the case of electrophoresis, what are the properties of the particles themselves that are the bases for the separation? Charge, size, and shape. All of those things are properties of the actual particles, and they all three matter. They all three determine either whether there's going to be movement through the gel, or if so, in which direction and how fast that movement will be. And charge is an important one among them, because if you have a collection of particles in your sample, and none of them, even though they're different kinds of particles, none of them has any charge, then electrophoresis should not be your choice of separation techniques, because they're all just going to sit there. A totally uncharged particle is not going to be attracted to either of the two electrodes. On the other hand, if at least some of the particles are charged, then you can separate. You can separate with electrophoresis charged particles from uncharged, positively charged from negatively charged, or even separate charged particles with the same charge from each other if they have different sizes or shapes. All right? So if there is a charge, there will be movement, and that movement will be in the direction of the oppositely charged electrode. Notice there's a notch right in the middle of the little form that you make wells with. If we had a sample that was a combination of positively charged and negatively charged particles, then we would have put the comb right in the middle so that the wells would be right in the middle of the gel, because some of those particles would move in one direction, some in the other. We didn't do that, though, because we knew that we were using DNA, and it doesn't matter where you get DNA from, it's always going to be negatively charged, which is why you arrange those wells at the negative end, because the DNA is going to be attracted to the oppositely positively charged end. Why is it that all DNA, regardless of source, is negatively charged? Right. First of all, let's think about what DNA and RNA, for that matter, are. They're nucleic acids, which are polymers, right? They're polynucleotides, which tells you that they are polymers whose monomers that they're made out of are nucleotides. And if you examine just a single nucleotide, any given nucleotide has three required components, right? What are those? You have to have a pentose sugar, which is a 5-carbon sugar, deoxyribose for DNA, ribose for RNA. And attached to that are two different things attached at different places. One of the things that's attached to it, which is the second required component, is some sort of nitrogenous base, which come in different varieties, and that's the whole basis for there being information in a nucleic acid. In other words, that's the only reason why there are different kinds of DNA nucleotides, because there are different nitrogenous bases. And so the sequence we talk about is really the sequence of nitrogenous bases. So that's hooked to one side of the pentose sugar. hooked to the other side is the third required component, which is some number of phosphate groups. Could be one, two, or three, typically. Now, if we have all three of those, it's a nucleotide. If we didn't have any phosphate, all we had is the pentose sugar and a nitrogenous base, what would that be called? That would be called a nucleoside. Same word with an S instead of a T. All right. For instance, if the pentose sugar specifically were ribose, and the nitrogenous base specifically were adenine, then that nucleoside we have would specifically be called adenosine. And if we had three phosphates attached to that, we would call it adenosine triphosphate, which is an example, ATP, which is an example of a nucleotide, because you have at least one phosphate connected to the nucleoside. But ATP, even though you can call it a nucleotide, you could also call it a nucleoside triphosphate. AMP is a nucleoside monophosphate. The monomers of DNA are all nucleoside monophosphates. Okay? Well, anyway, since each nucleotide has a phosphate in it, and all phosphates are negatively charged groups, that means the entire polynucleotide, the DNA or the RNA as a whole, is negatively charged, and therefore, regardless of the source, it's going to move toward the positive electrode. The basis of the separation, therefore, since they're all equally charged, similarly charged, I should say, they all have equal charge density, is their size and shape differences. And keep in mind, like I said when I described the mapping exercise, that the smallest particles have the easiest time getting through the gel. And therefore, they move the fastest during the trial, and they therefore will move the farthest in the allotted time. They will win the race, in a sense. The sample is a collection of different particles, all starting at the start line, which is the well. Smaller things will move faster. If they're the same size but different shape, they will also move at different speeds. A compact shape will get through there easier than the spread out shape, just like it's harder to walk through water if you're all spread out. So that's why these things will move at different speeds, and they therefore will form bands in the lanes, right? As far as today's, or the 2 week exercise that we're really trying to answer a question about, that question is whether or not your food is genetically modified. Answering that question really boils down to whether or not we amplify DNA that shouldn't be in the plant, right? By the PCR process. If we did amplify DNA that shouldn't be in the plant, in other words, if non-plant DNA was found and therefore was amplified, then we'll have enough of that DNA to actually be able to see it as a band on the electrophoresis gel. If we don't see it on the band, one explanation is that it didn't find any DNA and therefore it wasn't amplified. That's if everything goes right. Another way you could not see a band, though, is if something went wrong, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that's why we're using electrophoresis to answer the ultimate question. So you have six samples, but it's really three pairs of samples, right? Because you treated each sample twice, once with a green solution, once with a red solution. You have seven lanes that you made, though, because that seventh lane is dedicated to a molecular weight ruler. So that's a well. A molecular weight ruler is really just a standard solution containing a number of standards. They're called standards because you know about them going into the situation. They're not unknowns. And in this case, they are standard sizes. So it's a collection of particles of DNA of different sizes, but those sizes are known. And since they're different sizes, they're going to electrophorese at different rates and therefore cause several different bands that make it look like the rungs of a ladder. That's why this lane will be called a ladder. And since you know those sizes, and since you know that the smallest move the farthest, you can put those size numbers to the side of the gel. That can then be used as a measuring, as a ruler, basically, to measure the size of bands in your unknown lanes. All right? This brings up the important point that you can never compare one electrophoresis gel to another electrophoresis gel, even if you do both of the gels. And that's because in addition to the three things that were properties of the particles that matter to electrophoresis, there are other variables that matter as well that aren't actually properties of the particles. For instance, it matters what voltage is applied during the trial. The more voltage, the faster everything moves. Also, the more time you give it, the farther everything moves, right? And also, the consistency of the gel matters. When you mix the gel, you could mix it either a little lighter or a little heavier, thicker. And therefore, that's going to either speed up or slow down everything. Well, the only way to hold those three things constant is to have the same gel be used. And that's why you can compare different lanes within one gel to each other, or to the ruler, but you could never compare another one gel to another because those other three variables might not be kept constant. All right? Let's look quickly at a little slideshow. I want to go through the rationale of the experiment, mainly because this is one that you write up several sections for as an assignment, notice, or hopefully you've already noticed. And it's much better for you and for me grading them if you know what you're talking about when you're writing. So I want to explain this. Any given scientific experiment has controls in it for various reasons. Controls allow you to compare results for one thing, but also controls are important to make sure that you have done everything correctly or that no mistakes were made in an experiment. And that's a major reason why you have controls in today. That's why you don't just have your pair of unknown samples from the food that you chose, whatever that was. You also have a pair of samples from the oatmeal, and you have a pair of samples called GMO Plus. Those are serving as controls so that you can be sure nothing went wrong. If anything went wrong, then you can't trust the lanes for your unknown sample, even if those seem like there's no problem with them. Because if something went wrong in the other lanes, that's a red flag that something might have gone wrong for your sample that matters. The flowchart basically just, and I'll post this whole slideshow, by the way, on my announcements page, so you don't have to copy these words. It just runs through what you did. You extracted the DNA, hopefully, from the plant sources last time. You didn't have to extract it from GMO Plus. That was done for you, but you did it for oatmeal and your test sample. And if there was DNA that was found by the primers in your PCR mixture, then it was hopefully amplified. And if it was amplified, you should have enough to see as bands, and that's what allows you to answer the question of yes or no, is it GM or not? Now, I talked a little bit about the solutions that you used in PCR last time. I talked about the primers. I didn't specifically say what those primers were looking for. I just said they're looking for endpoints, right, of a section of DNA that you want to amplify. Well, in the case of the red stuff, which is looking for the GM, in other words, non-natural plant DNA, the endpoints are what you have to stick on to a gene if you're trying to put that gene from some other organism into a plant. It's not enough to just put that DNA into the plant DNA. It has to be recognized as a gene and therefore be transcribable, right? Because it's a big deal that the DNA is there. The reason you put the DNA in there is so that the plant can then make the corresponding protein that that gene codes for. To do that requires transcription. Otherwise, it would just be recognized as this intervening sequence of DNA that you have between the genes. That's the majority of your DNA and would do nothing. So in other words, you have to put a promoter on one end and you have to put a terminator on the other end so that the plant will recognize that as a gene and it will operate in transcription successfully. Well, the gene itself is the DNA between the promoter and the terminator. And that's different in all the different cases of transgenesis. But regardless of what gene they use from whatever source, they usually use the same promoter, tack it on the beginning end, and the same terminator, put it at the other end. That's what the primers in your solution are looking for, not the gene itself, but the promoter and the terminator. And therefore, if those endpoints are found, it will amplify those endpoints and the gene itself. The promoter sequence that's often used, most often used by far, is the CAMV35S. The CAMV of that stands for cauliflower mosaic virus, from which it comes naturally. So that's the promoter sequence. That's one of the endpoints that one of the types of red primers is looking for. The other is the NOS terminator, the other endpoint. NOS stands for nobiline synthase, in case you're curious. So that's what it's looking for. And it won't find that in a naturally occurring plant DNA. And if it doesn't find it, the primers don't anneal to anything, there's not going to be any amplification, and therefore there won't be any band in your gel. The green primers, stuff in the green solution, is looking for something that almost every naturally occurring plant should have. And that is a gene, the endpoints of a gene that codes for a photosystem. What is a photosystem? Remember this from 181? A photosystem is a complex of proteins that are embedded in the thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast and that hold on to pigment molecules of various sorts, different kinds of chlorophyll, carotenoids. The pigments are the things that actually absorb the photons, but they're held in place by photosystems and therefore allow photosynthesis to occur, or at least the light reactions of photosynthesis. That's when the light energy is harvested. All right, so all photosynthetic plants, which is almost all plants, there are some exceptions, some plants that have evolved photosynthesis away and they just parasitize other plants, but the vast majority of plants are photosynthetic and therefore should have this gene in them. And that's why as long as your food source is a plant source, which they all were, you should find this gene that these particular green primers are looking for. All right? That means if you don't find it, if you don't amplify that photosystem gene and therefore do not see a band, then that means something went wrong. And therefore that means you can't trust the results of your red lanes. If the green lane doesn't work, you can't trust whether or not there's a red band. So that's basically what I said right here. There's also a control for contamination, though. Now, the oatmeal was guaranteed to not be GM. It is definitely a plant, and therefore that oatmeal sample, which has two lanes, a green and a red lane, that green lane for the oatmeal definitely should have a band, because it's definitely a plant, and it's a photosynthetic plant. If it doesn't, something went wrong. It definitely should not, though, have a red band, because it's definitely not genetically modified. So if you get a band in lane 2, which I think was your red lane for oatmeal, then that's a red flag. The most likely explanation is that you've contaminated that oatmeal sample with genetically modified DNA. And if you did that, chances are you contaminated your unknown sample, the food you chose. So you can't trust the appearance of a red band in lane 4, which is your test food, if there's also a band in lane 2, which should not have a band. Does that make sense? Now, using the other control, which is the GMO plus, this is what's testing for successful PCR. That is, you didn't mortar and pestle that one, you just were given a solution of it. But that was definitely genetically modified plant DNA. So in lanes 5 and 6, which are corresponding to GMO plus, lane 5 is the green one. You definitely should have a band there because this stuff is definitely plant material. But you should also definitely have a band in lane 6 because it's guaranteed to be genetically modified. So if you don't have those bands, that also spells trouble. Okay, so the point here is lanes 1 and 2 and lanes 5 and 6, your control lanes, everything has to go right in those in order for you to be able to trust lanes 3 and 4, which are your test lanes. If you don't see the expected results in all four of the control lanes, then you can't definitively say yes or no that genetic modification is present. But assuming all four of those control lanes are correct, then you can look to lanes 3 and 4. Lane 3 should definitely have a band because it is a plant source that you chose. And lane 5 is the yes or no lane. If you don't have a band, that says non-genetic modification. If you do, it says yes, it is modified. But even then, even if everything went right in the control lanes, the absence of a band in lane 5 still is not definitive. If everything goes right in the controls and you do have a band in lane 4, then you can pretty reliably say that it was genetically modified. But if you don't have a band in lane 4, you can't definitively say that it was not genetically modified, and that's because this is not a completely universal test. I said that the CAM V35 promoter and the NOS terminator are the ones that are most often used. That's true for 85% of genetically modified plants in this country, at least. But that's not 100%. Remember, it's not detecting the gene, it's detecting the endpoints. So sometimes a gene is put into a plant using other endpoints instead of the two I mentioned. And therefore, the primers, which are looking for those specific endpoints, will not find that gene, even though it's unnatural. Therefore, it won't be amplified by PCR, and you won't have a band. So if everything goes right and you don't have a band in lane 4, there's just an 85% chance that you're correct when you say that it's non-genetically modified. There's a 15% chance that you have genetic modification that just eludes this particular test. You'd have to probe it with other primers in another round of PCR to really definitively pin it down. Does that all make sense? All right, then I probably burned through some time, and you're probably getting close to your 30 minutes expiring if they haven't already. Now, let me talk about processing this for a second. Your raw data is your pictures that you produce today. Now, you added tracking dye to these, and that's because the bands are invisible during the trial. You have no idea where they are. To see the bands, you either have to stain the gel afterwards or do what we're doing. These gels were made with stuff called gel red in them, a component of the gel, so it's throughout the gel. And it will preferentially bind to DNA if it's there, wherever it is. And when it binds, that combination of DNA and gel red will fluoresce under ultraviolet radiation, which is why we have these UV transilluminators. All right? So we don't have to bother with the staining. We just can look at them immediately using these. The tracking dye, though, is a way so you can monitor the progress of the electrophoretic trial. The dye itself is particles that are smaller than the smallest DNA that you're going to be using in that trial. So they move the fastest. They're winning the race, in a sense. You have the tracking dye so that you don't run it so long that everything falls off the edge and you lose the DNA samples. You want to run it so you spread them out enough, though, because if you don't run it long enough, then what will look like one band could actually be two bands that just haven't separated enough. Anyway, you want to take a picture of this for your raw data and to make your determination of whether it's GM or not. These transilluminators are safety-wise pretty foolproof, meaning that even when the switch is on, it's not really putting out UV, which you don't want to look into because it will harm your eyes even though it's invisible, because there's a secondary switch on the hinge. So only when this lid is closed is there actually light shining through, and this blocks out the UV, so it's safe to look at either way. But in order for the UV to go through the gel, it has to actually be on this platform, not on top of the lid, which means part of your cleanup involves wiping this down as well after you've put it on here. Now, After running electricity through your gels for a half hour, they get warm. So you take this warm gel, this warm wet gel out and put it on there and then close the lid. It's a confined space. It's immediately going to fog up. This one is still fogged from before. I wish they'd kept it open. It's going to fog up within about 1 second, which means you're not going to get a good picture if you're not already ready with the camera. All right? So one member of the group needs to go over to the light switches and turn all but one off just so that there's a little bit of light for the rest of the people to see. And then wait for the signal. Another member has the camera at the ready. Another member puts the gel down, closes the lid, and then gives the signal to the for the final light to be turned off. And then you take the snapshot immediately. Okay? And then you clean up. So now, if something went wrong, if your controls are, you know, if your lanes are messed up for any reason, you have to describe your results. So it's inconclusive if things went wrong. You have to explain that. But you can take a picture of an example gel up here that things went right on. Just don't treat this as your own. You can just use this as a comparison to discuss what the control lane should have looked like. But feel free to take a picture of that if you want. That's it.